from that classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me is a very special guest returning to the program after a long absence, but finally remembered for his great appearances previously on this show. It is Adam Johnson of Basketball Pantheon. Adam, welcome
back. Thanks for having me. How are you doing, Jason?
I'm doing great. Doing great. You know, it's of course an exciting time in the NBA. We're on the eve of free agency. You know, it's the off season. Sometimes is even more exciting than the season can be in the NBA. We get all the, of course, the exciting rumors, the exciting possibilities of, you know, new great teams forming, and you know, and it's just gotten more and more exciting in the NBA over recent years. And that made me think that maybe we should look at the biggest free agent signing for each NBA team, because obviously there are some teams that have an illustrious history of signing free agents. The Lakers, obviously, the Heat, some of the, you know, premier teams in NBA history. And then there are teams that have had relatively few free agents, and it's kind of interesting to look at the disparity between them and to sort of discuss and debate who might be the biggest free agent in each NBA team's history. And I thought of you as a connoisseur of NBA history, and I think it's a good topic to discuss.
Definitely. I was, when you sent me kind of the initial idea, I was in immediately. That's a very cool idea, and yeah, I think the people, our listeners here, will see the difference in some of the teams is pretty drastic. So in terms of who their best free agent signing is,
yes. So we kind of, and this is sort of a loose criteria, but this is meant to be how significant the free agent signing was seen to be at the time. So not necessarily something like in retrospect. You know, obviously there are some signings that were huge at the time that didn't really work out. There are some that of relatively minor players who turned out to be awesome players. So we're kind of trying to discuss how it would have been seen at the time, although there, again, we're probably going to differ from that from here and there, but just to get a sense of, you know, why your guy may not be on the list, just to kind of get a sense of that's sort of what we're looking at here. And you know, there isn't necessarily a centralized database on this. We used Basketball Reference a lot, of course. ABPR had, you know, good listing of significant free agent signings, a couple other sources as well. So, you know, I think we're pretty thorough and comprehensive, but if we somehow miss somebody important here and there, we apologize in advance. So looking, but before we get into that, I just want to look very briefly at NBA free agent history. You know, pre-1976, very, very limited amounts of free agency. Basically, if a team no longer wanted you anymore, you were going to be a free agent. Otherwise, you basically were stuck with your team as long as you wanted to. You could possibly sit out a year, which was called an option year, and become a free agent, but that, in practicality, didn't really happen very much. The ABA kind of changed things a little bit in the late 60s and into the 70s, but it was still pretty limited. Then once the NBA merger happened, there was a period from about 76 to 79 where any free agent signing came with compensation to the prior team. And then in 80 to 87, that basically is restricted free agency today, where you know, you could sign an offer sheet with a team, but the other team had a chance, your prior team had a chance to match. And there were a lot of compensation deals and trade type stuff that was worked out during that period. And from 88, that was the beginning of the modern system of having unrestricted free agents as well as having, you know, restricted players. It's been tweaked since. There's been addition of the rookie scale in 1996, addition of a sign-in trade in 99, and other things as well. But we've had a fairly similar system since 88, Tom Chambers being the first notable free agent that year, though we'll get into a few of the other ones from 88 because it's definitely a pretty interesting class.
Yeah, and I think just to be clear for everybody listening too, is on our criteria, there's a couple of these that I think by the very, very letter of the law are like sign-in trades, but they're essentially free agent signing. So, you know, I'm sure there's people who are going to try to be like pointing out things like that, but we wanted to keep it to what essentially were free agent signings, and that's kind of what made our list up, just so everybody knows that.
No, yeah, I'm glad I was going to mention that and I forgot, so I'm glad that you pointed that out. Yeah, so I mean, I consider, obviously, like LeBron James and Chris Bosh, right, to the Heat in 2010 were technically signing trades, but like they were, you know, they were driven by the fact that, you know, they would have gone to Miami no matter whether a signing trade had been accomplished or not. It was just, it was, you know, again, a technicality. So I consider those to be, you know, in that same category. So thank you for pointing that out. So We're going to go by the more recent teams added to the league to the earliest teams in the league. Why? I don't know. It's just the way that I decided to choose it. So actually, we're putting the Hornets and the Pelicans in a special category. They're going to join with the Hornets history, and then we're going to split out the Pelicans history because I know people say it's not confusing, but I think it's confusing. So we're not starting with the Pelicans or the Hornets. We're going to start with the Grizzlies. So in their history, it's mostly been Memphis. A couple of the notable free agents that they've had, James Posey in 2003. He was, at that point, he was, kind of a young, rising, sort of 3-and-D type player, even though I don't think that was quite in vogue yet in 2003, but, kind of a little bit like whichever Ariza is today. Younger at that point, of course. They had some fading stars. Allen Iverson at the very end in 2009, and then Gilbert Arenas at the end of the 2012 season came along. Neither one of those lasted, of course, for very long. And the guy who I would say probably is our choice would be Chandler Parsons in 2016. Big free agent signing, and unfortunately his health has prevented him from making much of an impact. He had one absolutely terrible season, and then one season where he was sort of okay, but obviously not producing with a high level contract to be. There was sort of the thought that there was some potential with him, Mike Conley and Marc Gasol to form, what could have been a deep playoff team or, fringe championship contender type team, but that has not worked out. Health concerns have beguiled them all. Is there, do you have any additions to that list or anyone who you would debate differently?
Not any additions, but yeah, more so just the Parsons thing. It's like, I mean, obviously in hindsight, it looks awful, but at the time, and even at the time, people were, if he stays healthy, was kind of the key word there. But yeah, that really was like, hey, maybe this is a way to kind of extend this grit and grind era and like evolve it rather than reset. And they thought, this is a perfect piece to kind of slot in a much more offensive minded guy than like the Tony Allen, piece that they'd had prior in that position. So yeah, and it just has backfired, dramatically. And it's now, possibly the worst contract in the NBA. So so yeah, it's very crazy how 2 years can shift, someone's thinking towards a contract that drastically. And Allen Iverson, who couldn't forget the three games, he played in the 09-10 season for the Grizzlies. Yeah, it didn't quite work out.
No. Yeah, Arenas was, I think for Iverson and Arenas, that was both their last NBA stops. Maybe did Iverson play with the Sixers
he
afterward,
did.
Or was that?
Yeah, before? 25 games later okay. That season with the Sixers, and then that was it.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's a better send-off than three games with the Grizzlies. Yeah, they made there's sort of some odd decisions there, despite, of course, they've had, quite a few years of very good success the last few years, not as much because of injuries and age and things like that. But like even when they were, building this kind of weird, out of nowhere team, with Randolph and Tony Allen and, some guys who, and even Mike Conley, who some guys who were kind of maligned at the time for their contracts turned out to be great. But they also, were bringing in Allen Iverson there. So which obviously was not even seen as a great idea at the time. He was pretty much he was pretty much done at that point, obviously. So next we have the Toronto Raptors. The key players there that not an illustrious with some big names here, but not necessarily at the point of their careers where you would be wanting to add them. The first, Charles Oakley, 1999. Of course, advanced in his career, he began in I think 87 or so. Although honestly, I think he was definitely a big catalyst for the cultural change that they kind of brought in. Obviously Vince Carter was, rookie and it was an emerging star. They had Antonio Davis and some other good veterans there. Kind of a nice mix of young players and veterans, actually, that, led them to a, fairly deep playoff run. And it looked like it had the potential to be a very good team until, kind of issues with the team and Carter kind of derailed that. But he definitely was, even though he was more of a limited role player on the court, he was definitely part of, the big change that they had there. Also, Hakeem Olajuwon in 2002, that was a sign and trade, but obviously that less of an on-court impact, but just, a big star, leaving the team that he had gone to forever to go to Toronto. Also, Rafer Alston in 2004 was kind of a young up-and-coming player, not really a, notable star, but, was kind of in the names here. And then Mihail Turgulu from 2009, kind of actually had forgotten all about this one, but after, he had those, great years in Orlando, led them to a finals appearance, or one of the key players in that finals appearance, he ended up, I believe, flirting with the Blazers and nearly signing with them, and then spurning the Blazers and going to the Raptors. I think he had even agreed with the Blazers and sort of a DeAndre Jordan situation and went off of that and went to the Raptors, and that really worked out. He ended up with the Magic, and you know, a couple years later, I think went to the Suns too, actually, if I'm not mistaken. So he kind of bounced around there, but I think was definitely seen as, you know, a big star at the time. You know, could have paired with Bosch and, you know, and brought them kind of back to respectability. I think they kind of played okay. You know, had Carl Run, who was sort of seen as a, you know, pretty good young point guard at the time. So, you know, interesting what that could have looked like in hindsight, but yeah, that's kind of a funny one.
Yeah, no, I think that was a big one at the time. I mean, coming off of a finals appearance where he was a huge role, he played a huge role in that 09 finals run for Orlando, and I think people thought, hey, you know, this is something that can, yeah, I think the Bosch, the thing that you said, you can pair with Bosch and, you know, fit well. One guy can pop out, one guy can, you know, kind of handle the ball, handle pick and roll, and kind of a versatile team. Maybe would have been a little bit ahead of their time if it was like the actual version of Hedo that the Magic got in the playoffs, but it just wasn't. And yeah, didn't quite go to plan. I think he only lasted one season there. So yeah, rough one there.
I would say of the names here, I think he's probably the biggest one at the time. Given the context, I mean, Oakley was, I think, kind of a different category. I think he was important, but I don't think he definitely wasn't as big of a, you know, productive star as Turkoglu was at that time, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So next we have the Minnesota Timberwolves. We have Sam Mitchell coming over from the Pacers in 1995. This was a very this is kind of a thin list. So the fact that Sam Mitchell gets on there, although he obviously spent a long time with the Timberwolves, was kind of an important part. Again, kind of more of a cultural shift kind of guy than the impact on the court. Malik Sealy in 1998. Chauncey Billups in 2000. Now he kind of revived his career with the Timberwolves. Before then, he had bounced around quite a bit already, but he had just been, you know, he was a couple years away from being the number three draft pick, so that seems like a relatively significant one. And then, interesting one, 2012, Andre Kirilenko and Brandon Roy. You know, Kirilenko returning from a couple years in Russia and actually had a really good season with the Wolves that year. Of course, he'd had, you know, his best years with the with the Utah Jazz. And then Brandon Roy, he had retired from the Portland Trailblazers, but decided to make a comeback, and you know, that was certainly celebrated at the time, or seen as like, okay, maybe he could do it. That if it had been the kind of thing that had paid off, it obviously would have been, you know, huge coup, because, you know, Brandon Roy was an awesome player for a long time, but unfortunately his comeback did not last very long because of the knee issues. Kirilenko had an excellent year, but then ended up leaving Minnesota and going to Brooklyn to join with the KG, Paul Pierce, Darren Williams, Brooke Lopez attempted a super team there, but yeah, that was kind of a fun year. That was sort of an up and coming Wolves team with Ricky Rubio, Kevin Love, with Rick Adelman as the coach. They were kind of seen as, you know, on the rise and maybe a team that, you know, was gonna, you know, kind of finally break through, and then a lot of injuries and other issues kind of derailed them until they've, you know, gotten to the new incarnation that they've, you know, finally gotten to the playoffs now.
I remember the Brandon Roy one at the time was much more out of hope than it was out of realistic expectations, but obviously a big name. But yeah, you're right, I mean, this is a very thin group. Chauncey, I remember, yeah, those 2 years, especially I think that second one, it was when he became a starter for most of that season, and people kind of thought, hey, you know, this is like now the actual point guard that we can pair with KG after, you know, the earlier, you know, ill-fated Stephon Marbury relationship. But yeah, the next year he moved on to Detroit, and for Chauncey, at least the rest is history.
Yeah, I'm not sure, honestly, if there's one who I would pick here who I would say, like, is the right one. It's rough. I guess maybe Kirilenko. I guess in terms of like a notable, like, he was probably the most productive player at the time. You know, he had the best NBA track record of all these guys, which is, you know, kind of rough to say. But I mean, Roy combined with the expectation of, okay, he could continue that production, because Roy obviously was the most productive one. But he'd, you know, the expectation, as you mentioned, was pretty, you know, it was more of a hope than a realistic expectation.
Yeah, Kirilenko, yeah, had played that lockout season in CSKA Moscow right before that. So I think I agree. I guess it's Kirilenko. That's pretty rough. But
so next we have Orlando Magic, and some really interesting ones here. Horace Grant in 1994, leaving the Bulls, and after Michael Jordan had retired, and moving on to a team again that looked like a really, you know, rising Eastern Conference power. You know, Magic, or excuse me, not Magic Johnson, obviously, but the guy who was compared a lot to Magic Johnson, Penny Hardaway and Shaquille O'Neal, you know, looking like they were going to be an awesome tandem for a long time. And, you know, Horace Grant really adding some credibility to that team, and of course, adding, you know, a really good piece that could fit in along with those guys. after, you know, that era went away after Shaq left for the Lakers, after, you know, Penny Hardaway's injuries and leaving, the new era began with Tracy McGrady and Grant Hill in 2000. Grant Hill in particular obviously was, you know, one of the great established star at the time with the Pistons, and had, you know, was maybe not quite MVP level player, but, you know, definitely, you know, top 10, top 5, you know, all NBA type player, and looked like he, you know, was in his mid-20s and was looking like he was going to have, you know, a great career ahead of him. He did Turkoglu in 2004, you know, was not, probably actually not, at the time wasn't necessarily seen as that huge of a deal. I mean, he had some pretty good years with the Kings, but was not, you know, more coming off the bench and, you know, potential good young player there. Rashard Lewis in 2007, I think was another one who was more like a fringe type all-star type player. So I think not quite on the level of obviously not the level of Grant Hill. I think he would be the choice for me here, but I'm interested in what you think about that.
Yeah, and I remember the Rashard Lewis deal getting heavily criticized at the time too, because it was, which sounds like nothing now, but $20 million a year. For a player who at the time people were like, oh, you can't, you know, build around it, but he ended up being, you know, really big for them. And I mean, they don't make the finals without Rashard Lewis, so that's tough. But no, Grant Hill absolutely has to win this. And people also remember that was the summer they were going after Tim Duncan. I think that was the initial plan. I mean, being from San Antonio, I definitely remember every kid at school signing the "Stay Tim, Stay" banners at you know, grocery stores and things like that. That everyone was terrified that he was going to leave. And I mean, that so to me, yeah, Grant Hill is the clear winner. Obviously, Tracy McGrady went on to have the best stint as an Orlando Magic player, but yeah, Grant Hill at the time surely wins this.
Yeah, no, I absolutely would agree with that for sure. So next we have the New Orleans Hornets and Pelicans. We're going to go with the New Orleans years first, and then we'll discuss the Charlotte Hornets, Bobcats, and second Hornets teams. For New Orleans, we have Chris Anderson, the Birdman, in 2004, kind of a basically just you know, good up and coming young player, played for Denver and was, you know, obviously athletic type big man. You know, nothing particularly special. These are not the best names here. But although genuine all-star level player, Peja Stojakovic, 2006, he'd played for the Kings and then was traded to the Pacers when it became apparent when they were looking to make a change and it became apparent that he wasn't going to come back. And then he ended up signing with the Pelicans. Unfortunately, injuries kind of derailed his time there for the most part, although he was able to close his career with a helping the Mavericks win the championship in 2011. And then Morris Peterson, who was in 2007, who was a long mainstay with that team, and or at least he was there for a few years and kind of a solid player. But honestly, I think of the players, certainly at the time, I think Stojakovic would be clearly the winner here.
Yeah, no question. When Mo Pete and Birdman are your competition, that's pretty easy to do.
So for the Charlotte version of the franchise, and these are all pretty much, you know, these are all Hornets. I don't think the Bobcats actually had a entry here. So a couple early choices that I think are more name value than productionist players, but I think they're worth noting. Kurt Rambis in 1988, the expansion year. He actually did come as a free agent, though. And Robert Parrish, 1994, leaving the Celtics for the Hornets. At that point, were, you know, looking like a young up-and-coming team with Alonzo Mourning and Larry Johnson, you know, and some very, very fun team, and, you know, had sort of a look in popularity at that point. And then after that, that era kind of fell apart. Bobby Phills and David Wesley in 1997. Probably not quite there on this list, but definitely were up there. Derek Coleman in 1998. He'd averaged 17-10 for Philly in the previous season. So, you know, he was not seen as a superstar at this point, but was still seen as a productive player. And then a couple for the actually we do have one Bobcat on here. I was mistaken. We have Al Jefferson from 2013. He was a Bobcat for 1 year, I believe, and then became a Hornet for the rest of his tenure there. You know, led them to their first playoff appearance in quite a while. And even though it didn't work out, they got smashed pretty well by the Heat. They had you know, he brought them definitely some respectability, and, you know, was their big star when they had the name change. And the other big star when they became the Hornets again, Lance Stephenson, 2014, which worked out pretty disastrously for the team, but that was definitely seen as a big deal for them. He was seen as a, you know, pretty big get and a guy who could, you know, kind of fill the missing piece for them in terms of, you know, some ball handling, some defense, you know, all that. All the encore stuff that he was supposed to do would have fit pretty well, but he forgot how to shoot for like a year and a half and ended up being, you know, one of the bigger, more disastrous signings in modern NBA history, for sure.
Yeah, the Stevenson one at the time, I fell for it as well. I thought, hey, you know, if his kind of shot creation can work well next to Kemba Walker, and you know, if he can bring what he did in Indiana onto this team, and yeah, new look and everything, is like we were all kind of fooled by that. And like you said, it was a total disaster. I mean, it just about as bad of a free agent signing as there has been in the last 4 or 5 years. But yeah, the Al Jefferson one, I thought, I forgot how big that was at the time, that it was like, wow, someone wants to go to Charlotte, you know? And I think that was one of the first ones where like the Michael Jordan influence like really played a role. I remember him kind of citing that, and also they offered him the most money, which, you know, as a human being, that makes sense. But yeah, and I do remember that first playoff series, like, oh, this is cool. This may be a team that can kind of build for the future. And that was the series where LeBron had the dunk where he's looking at Michael Jordan kind of out of the side of his eye. And, you know, I thought, you know, maybe this will be kind of another little team that can be one of like LeBron's punching bags, and they couldn't even be that. So, oh well.
No, unfortunately. Yeah. Oh well. Well, yeah, what you can do. I would say that Jefferson's probably the clear choice here. You know, the others kind of had some name value, but in terms of being a productive player and, you know, relatively in their prime, I think Jefferson would be number one for me.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, and I think, yeah, this history is weird. I think if I have it right, is it not, I think it's 88 to 2002, and then 04 to now is the technical Charlotte Hornets history, yet 03, I think, to now is the Bobcat or the Pelicans. It's very bizarre. I remember when I had to do that, yes, for my franchise rankings on my site, I just thought, okay, this is a very strange way to do this. There's like a missing year for the Hornets, but yeah, this is a good way to do it too. And I think if for both teams, I think Al Jefferson would probably win. Well, I don't know. I guess Peja, that's probably more of a toss up than I think. But
I guess I would. Yeah, that's interesting because I think Peja was closer. I think he had the higher peak at you know, and he was probably really relatively close.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, so, I guess Peja would still win that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, I would, yeah, but I would say, I mean, if it's reasonably well, you know, the New Orleans version is, you know, is Peja, and yeah, the Charlotte version, I think, would be.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, our next team here is a little easier to determine who the winner is.
Yes, it is, in fact. Obviously, the Miami Heat, LeBron James and Chris Bosh, obviously LeBron being the big one in 2010. That is clearly, you know, without a doubt, probably the biggest free agent signing in NBA history. Probably LeBron has two of the top five for sure. So, not much doubt there. The only really other notable ones I thought were Lamar Odom in 2003, coming from the Clippers, and then Antoine Walker in 2005, coming in a very, very complex sign and trade. And even Walker was more of, I mean, he was a name, and he had come from, you know, he'd become kind of as a star player from the Celtics and was, you know, sort of transitioning into like the second phase of his career as more of a role player. Actually did pretty well at that, better than I think anyone would kind of anticipated him doing, at least for, you know, a couple years as they won the championship in 06.
Yeah, I think his you know, theoretical spacing, if not, he wasn't quite as effective as a three-point shooter as he did as he was as a Celtic, but his theoretical spacing helped, you know, clear the paint for Shaq and D-Wade and those guys. And yeah, I think he was much better about just playing a role rather than having to be the guy or anything like that. And also, I can't remember if we mentioned this earlier, or if you and I even talked about this, but we did not include buyout candidates, just so everyone knows, you know, in the mid-season kind of signings and things like that, and also guys who maybe opted out of the contract but then re-signed with that same team. So if anybody has like gotten to this point in the list, like, oh, where's this guy, that might be part of it as well.
Right, yeah, we did not do, you know, re-signing your own players did not count in this. And it, most of the mid-season buyout type things, I don't, you know, if you were bought out by another team, there's probably a reason, right, why you were, you know, not, you're unlikely to have been, you know, you may have been once a very good player, you're a helpful role player, but this is not, it isn't quite the same as that. So, but that also good to note in case anyone was confused about that. But next with Dallas Mavericks, and I was surprised that there were very not really notable '80s, I guess, is understandable because it really not until '88 were there a lot of free agents, but none really in the '90s, and they were a pretty miserable team in the '90s. Yeah. So I guess that sort of makes sense. But honestly, their history of attracting free agents is more limited than I had sort of expected. The key players: Tim Hardaway in 2001, after his great Miami Heat years, he went to the Mavericks and didn't really thrive there. He was I think in his early 30s by then, and obviously he's a smaller point guard. Usually that doesn't work out so well. Sean Marion in 2009, after he, of course, he spent most of his career with the Suns, then went kind of bounced around with the Heat and the Raptors before ending up with the Mavericks, and we, of course, became a very important part of their championship team in 2011. And Chandler Parsons in 2014, again, coming from the Houston Rockets to go to the Mavericks, and that was definitely a big signing at the time. This is kind of a toss up to me. I don't know, because I think Marion is the best player of these players overall. Parsons at the time, I think, because he was younger, may have been seen as the bigger catch, but that's a tough one for me.
Yeah, I think Marion. It's weird for a team who since their title in 2011 has kind of like prided themselves on the rolling over their cap space to like use in free agency. They don't really have anyone of note to brag about. But Parsons, I guess, kind of was that one win. Chandler, Maxer, nothing, bitch, Parsons. I guess like their one thing to show from that, which that only lasted 2 years. So yeah, I would lean Marion. At that point, you know, multiple time All-Star and bigger name. And then, you know, I guess if our tiebreaker is what do they do with the team, then I guess that has to go to Marion too.
Yeah. I would say, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's close, but I think Marion probably beats it, but I could kind of see either way. Next, we have the Jazz. Began, of course, in New Orleans, and then later went to, of course, been in Utah forever. But honestly, two of their most interesting signings were in New Orleans. And one of the very, very first key free agent signings, Gail Goodrich from the Lakers in 1976. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, this was during the days of compensation, and the Jazz were forced to give up several huge draft picks, which led to them losing out on a chance to draft Magic Johnson in 1980. So this ended up not being a very good deal for the Jazz. Although at the time, it made some sense to pair up Goodrich and Pete Maravich together. That was a backcourt that was definitely very interesting and had some really good potential on it. And when they were actually on the court together, it actually did work fairly well. But Goodrich suffered a pretty serious knee injury, and of course was not quite the same. Maravich dealt with injuries too, so that wasn't it wasn't the worst idea in the world, but given what they had to give up at the time, and it was the first year for compensation, so there was not really a great baseline for what a team would have to give up for a player. So it's hard to blame the Jazz entirely on that, but obviously that's something that derailed them for quite a long time. They didn't make the playoffs until the mid '80s, a large amount of account on that, and they had to leave New Orleans because they couldn't field a successful team struggled with that. Also in the 70s, Chuck Robinson, 1977, I think it was Atlanta where he came from, and I think he later went to Phoenix. But a terrific rebounder, actually had a first-team All-NBA that year. Kind of one of those players who kind of did that out of nowhere, and was kind of a solid player for most of the rest of his career, but for a short time was absolute beast. And then Carlos Boozer in 2004, this one's sort of been forgotten, but it was hugely controversial at the time because they basically had a wink-wink deal with the Cavs to let him out of his a relatively small deal so that the Cavs would be able to sign him with the money that they had. And then Boozer ended up going to Utah for a much larger amount of money that the Cavs were unable to pay. So there were some accusations of dirty dealings at the time. But Boozer, of course, had some great success with the Jazz over the next few seasons.
Yeah, the Boozer one I remember being very strange because it was clearly seen after that first year of him and LeBron playing together, like, hey, this could really be a nice combo kind of to move forward with and grow old together. And
right.
LeBron really never got that player within his first in Cleveland. That was kind of like a peer of his that he could kind of grow old with. And so I think it's one of those what ifs, like, might be a slightly alternate history if he would have stayed. But that was a big deal for Jazz.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would guess Boozer probably would be the I don't know, maybe Boozer or Goodrich. Goodrich was older at that point as a player. Robinson was he was very, very young, and I guess they were much shorter peaks, but he had the larger peak. The best season than Boozer ever had with the Jazz. So this was pretty much toss up. I guess we could kind of go with almost there's a decent argument for any of them.
Yeah, I'm. I'll go Boozer. Just I guess given what he lasted the longest of the three, so that'll be my tiebreaker.
So next we have the Cavs, and this is pretty much another slam dunk one. LeBron James going back in 2014, coming home. Really no question about this one. The only others that seem at all significant were Scott Wedman in 1981, coming from the Kansas City Kings, and the Cavs had to give up a first round pick for compensation. That was one of many first round picks the Cavs were giving up during that time. The Cavs were very ambitious in this summer. They were able to add James Edwards, who was a good young player for the Pacers, of course, better known later for being part of the Bad Boy Pistons. Bob Wilkerson from the Bulls, and they also tried to sign Otis Birdsong from the Kings, but the Kings matched that one, so they were trying to turn around their team trying to get some established players. Unfortunately for them, it did not work out that well, though Wedman was a solid player, was a multiple-time All-Star at that point, and would later, of course, contribute to the 80 Celtics. And the other one would be Larry Hughes, an attempt to get LeBron James a backcourt mate that he could grow old with. The Cavs brought in Larry Hughes. Unfortunately, did not work out very well. Their skills did not fit pretty very well. Hughes declined, you know, at a relatively young age, and not a situation that worked very well. But I guess it put LeBron in a position to leave the team and then come back to the team in 2014. So,
yep, there you go. This is a no-brainer. LeBron again. I think he's going to be our only two-time winner of this little award here. So, yeah, this one was easy.
Yeah, there you go. Next, we have the Clippers, and not an illustrious free agent history, as you may not be surprised to learn. And no one really during their Braves days, you know, was notable necessarily as a free agent. They had a couple in 1979 after they had moved to San Diego. The big one being Bill Walton, and obviously he was a former MVP, but had been out for about a year and a half because of serious knee and foot injuries at that point. But was obviously seen as there was I don't know. I mean, I think there was some. It wasn't like it was just like hope, like, okay, he can be healthy. I think there was some thought at the time that, okay, this stuff is behind him, he can be a good player. And then as he soon dealt with injuries early on that season, there was some realization of, oh no, this is, you know, going to be a much longer issue for him. But at the time, I think it was seen like, okay, yeah, they're bringing this guy in. Of course, Walton from San Diego, you know, coming home, all that good stuff, that was huge for him. They also had Brian Taylor that year, who was a veteran who had been part of some championship teams with the Nets, and actually oddly declared himself a free agent during his first year with the Nuggets. He had kind of a contract dispute with them, and it was kind of eventually settled by going to the Clippers and getting the Nuggets getting some competition back. Only other really notable free agent, I think, would be Baron Davis in 2008. You know, he was obviously a big star coming from the We Believe Clippers at that point. And, you know, was expected a team with Elton Brand and, put and be a, you know, a fairly solid Clippers team in the late 2000s. Unfortunately, Elton Brand decided he wanted to go elsewhere, went to Philly, and Baron was left to be taunted by Donald Sterling at courtside.
Yeah, that Baron Davis one was big at the time. I mean, yeah, you talked about that We Believe Warriors team being so fun, and even that 2008 Warriors team barely missed the playoffs. It wasn't like they had a disastrous season. I mean, he was still a very good player, very productive player, and, yeah, I mean, Walton, in terms of name, certainly would take the cake here. But even at that point, there had already been the injury concerns. So, yeah, I mean, probably Walton wins this one. But Baron Davis was a big deal.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely a big deal. The Blazers, not really a huge free agent history. It's kind of some notable ones were Rod Strickland in 1992 and Kenny Anderson in 1996. Kenny Anderson coming from the Hornets after he played mostly with the Nets, and he ended up being traded, I believe, a year and a half later in the Dame and Sotomayor deal, so not really a long-lasting situation there. For Strickland, he had come from the Spurs and played for the Knicks, I believe, as well. So he was more kind of seen as like, you know, young potential type player, and, you know, was ended up kind of being more of like a solid point guard. But yeah, honestly, neither one of these guys were you know, particularly notable or particularly lasted super long with their franchise. I think I would say Anderson may have been slightly the bigger star at the time, but it's very much a toss up. The Blazers have not really, you know, they've acquired most of their guys through the draft or through trades, but you know, free agents really have not come to Portland in general.
Yeah, and the ones that have not really worked out. So yeah, I think you know, the Rod Strickland one was kind of a, hey, let's bring him in. It's actually the only season of his career where he played shooting guard was that first season, you know, until Terry Porter moved on, and then it was time for him to kind of take the reins as the primary point guard. But yeah, neither one is a massive deal, and that just kind of goes to show you, not every city is a free agent destination. As much as I love Portland, not everyone does.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah. So, yeah, that's notable because obviously they've been a pretty successful franchise during their time, but it's odd, yeah, that they've had relatively lacking in terms of, you know, signing, bringing free agents there. Perhaps they will find success eventually. You never know. But another city that has not exactly had the lure of some of the great free agents, Milwaukee with the Bucks. Their most notable are Moses Malone in 1991, very, very late into his career. Anthony Mason in 2001, joining a team that had made the Eastern Conference Finals, and kind of unfortunately ruining their chemistry, basically, and leading that team to be broken up. And Greg Monroe in 2015, who was, you know, kind of seen as one of their first big free agents in quite a while, ended up doing okay there off the bench, although I think was hoped to be a bigger star when he came in. I think Giannis developing so fast and becoming such a big star, you know, kind of led, you know, Monroe, put him in sort of a different situation there. But yeah, this one's another one where the options are not, you know, all that terrific, I would say.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Greg Monroe thing, I remember just being significant because he kind of spurned the Knicks and the Lakers. You know, it was like, oh, wow, like, you know, this is a guy, you know, not signing with one of the big markets and signing with Milwaukee. Like, this is the new NBA. But, you know, we look back and we're like, oh, Greg Monroe, that doesn't make a lot of sense to make, you know, a big bunch of noise about that one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess Moses, just historically being the great player that he was, maybe the winner here by default. But again, the choices here, not outstanding. Slightly better circumstances, though, the Phoenix Suns. Of course, as we talked about earlier, the very first unrestricted free agent, Tom Chambers, in 1988, coming from the Sonics. And, you know, was a driving force for, you know, their great success in the late 80s and early 90s. They're a team that, you know, was looking to make a huge turnaround after they'd had some drug scandals in the late 80s and, you know, moved away from, you know, some of the Walter Davis and some of their, you know, stars they'd had for the last decade or so. Alvin Adams had retired. You know, they were kind of a new guard coming in. They would get Kevin Johnson and, you know, have some really good seasons before Chambers would leave, and they'd bring in Charles Barkley. Danny Manning, 1994, coming from the Hawks after he'd spent most of his career with the Clippers, signing for a very cheap one-year deal before signing a longer-term contract afterward. Penny Hardaway, 1999, was signing trade after things had gone sour with the Orlando Magic. And I think probably the clear winner, well, we'll talk about this, I guess. Steve Nash, 2004, I think obviously became the most significant free agent they signed, but how it was seen at the time, that might be questionable. I think, you know, he was certainly a star. He played some really good years with the Mavericks, but he was, you know, in his late 20s or maybe even 30 at that point, and was, you know, there was some question as to whether he would really be able to, you know, hold up, much less, obviously, I don't think anyone expected MVP-type form coming from him at that point.
No, yeah, I think if you look at this, you just look at the four names and you think, oh, yeah, obviously Nash, but that Penny Hardaway one was huge at the time, and, I mean, Nash, knowing what we know now, I mean, that signing really kind of changed offensive basketball in the NBA as we know it. So it's like, obviously, that one, pretty big deal. But at the time, you know, he was an all-star player and a player that, you know, oh, this, you know, really fills a need, especially as they'd moved on from Marbury. But yeah, I think the Penny Hardaway one might, in the moment, actually win this one for me.
Okay, yeah. The Chambers one was a big deal, too. I mean, yeah. He was obviously, yeah, I mean, he was a pretty big, you know, he'd been, I think, MVP of the All-Star game that year before, and was, you know, was a pretty good big star for Seattle. You know, just coming into his prime, was great forward, you know. I mean, he was, he was very marketable, I think, at the time, too, you know. So, yeah, it's a tough, I think it's awesome. I would say Hardaway. I would agree with you on Hardaway, but if it had not already been for like the knee concerns that he was dealing with already, I mean, it wasn't at that point obviously seen as though a thing that was definitely guaranteed going to derail him, but it was an issue at the time, so that maybe, you know, causes some slight downgrade for me, but it's close. I think you could say, yeah, I honestly, I think any of the three, of Chambers, Hardaway, or even Nash, I think, you know, could be called for this one. That one's a really tough one to say.
Yeah, and even Danny Manning was an all-star right before they signed him. So, yeah, Phoenix actually a better track record than you would expect on some of these free agents.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Next, we have the Nets, and another not-so-good track record here. Orlando Woolrich in 1987, he had been dealing with substance abuse problems and dealing with, you know, being on the Bulls, you know, before Michael Jordan got there. There was some hope that, you know, he would be able to pair with Jordan and be a great player, but was not a good fit and had dealt with the problems that he was dealing with. So he was shipped out for a number of draft picks and was brought to the Nets as an attempt to start over, which did not work out particularly well. And then another one that's easy to forget about, Alonzo Mourning in 2003. He had, you know, of course, been a huge star with the Heat and then dealt with his kidney disease that kept him out of the NBA for a while, and he was making his comeback and signed a lucrative deal with the Nets. And this was, you know, right after the Nets were coming off of, you know, finals appearances, you know, with Jason Kidd there, and we're kind of just, you know, a really good big man away from maybe, you know, possibly, you know, in a series against Shaq, maybe Alonzo Mourning, you know, could have not stopped him necessarily, but contained him a little bit more than, you know, some of the other parade of guys that they were bringing out there. So there was some hope that, hey, maybe this is the thing that we need to do to go over the top. But unfortunately, the health was really not there, and that team was about to kind of fall apart anyway. So, in terms of how it was seen at the time, I think this definitely, without really any other good options other than Orlando Woolrich, I think this is pretty clearly the winner.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, if you had to guess, I don't know if you've looked at this or not, so maybe this will ruin if you have, but if you had to guess how many games Alonzo Mourning played for the Nets, what would you guess?
Ooh, I would guess,
wow,
maybe
close,
40?
30, exactly 30.
Not bad. Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah. Because of course he was part of the Vince Carter trade,
yep,
a couple years later, I believe. So, yes. There you go. Yeah. That was not a good number, obviously. So next we have the Denver Nuggets, and sort of a mix of guys here. They had Walter Davis in 1988, Dale Ellis in 1994, Antonio McDyess in 1998. Very interesting story, which we'll get to in a second. Andre Miller in 2003 and Paul Millsap in 2017. And I would say McDyess or Millsap would definitely be the two that I would think of here as the biggest ones. McDyess, of course, played a year with the Suns after being traded from the Nuggets, and then was wooed back by the Nuggets, signing an extremely lucrative deal. There were stories of the Suns being kept out of the arena, of Denver barricading the arena to keep McDyess in there to sign that deal, of some crazy shenanigans going on there. Unfortunately, McDyess soon suffered an ACL injury, or it was a pretty serious injury that kind of kept him from reaching his potential as a superstar. But absolutely, at the time, he looked like a young, up-and-coming, great superstar. And then Millsap was older in his career, but was, you know, productive, multi-time all-star, and expected to pair with some of their young core to produce a playoff team, and came very, very close to that this season. So there's a lot, of course, there's some time to tell with that, but in terms of how it was seen at the time, I would say, you know, those are the two that definitely are up there.
Yep, yeah, I'd go with McDyess on this one. I think McDyess, the injuries are tough, because he ended up actually having a longer career than people realize, but just much more as a role player, kind of one of those guys that lost a step and lost the ability to dominate, but was still, you know, just through his own talent, able to contribute. I think Antonio McDyess would have had a very, very nice career if not for the injuries.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think of a little bit like a Bob McAdoo without, like, the obviously the MVP level highs, but had, like, the potential to be, you know, was more like a, you know, second team all NBA type player, and could have been that for, like, quite a long time. You know, I think he was about that good, and absolutely could have been huge for sure. So next we have the Houston Rockets, and the notable names here, Rick Barry, 1978. We're going to have more Rick Barry as we get through here, because he's pretty important in free agent history. But late in his career, went to the Rockets, and was the Rockets had to send John Lucas, who had been a former number one overall pick, to the Warriors in exchange. But Barry was expected to pair with Moses Malone and Rui Tomjanovic and Calvin Murphy to have a contending team. Didn't quite work out, as Barry he was still a solid player, but lost a step and was unable to, you know, bring them over the top there. Also, Malone dealt with some injuries and didn't help the situation. Scottie Pippen in 1998 of leaving the championship Bulls and joining Charles Barkley and Hakeem Olajuwon in Houston. Then moving on to more recent times, Jeremy Lin in 2011. This one's, in retrospect, this one's obviously funny because, you know, Lin didn't end up becoming a particularly great player, but absolutely he was one of the biggest names in the NBA at this point in 2011 as with his, you know, Lin Sanity year with the Knicks, and this was absolutely, you know, a huge deal in, you know, more cultural terms and popularity terms. And Dwight Howard in 2013, obviously coming from the Lakers, having been, you know, just recently an MVP candidate and still, you know, multi-time All-Star, you know, not old, in his late 20s at this point, so still, you know, theoretically in his prime, although the physical toll, which I don't think was 100% apparent at that point, you know, led him to decline earlier than I think people expected.
Yeah, the Dwight Howard one was huge. I mean, especially getting a guy to leave LA, I think was seen as, you know, I mean, really kind of historic at that time. You know, there was like, you know, that's where everyone kind of wants to get, including Dwight. And then it's like, okay, you have the chance to re-sign here, and he didn't take it. So that was big. The Lin one, that's the classic, you know, poison pill and kind of the fear from like Knicks fans that that they did not re-sign him after that magical little, you know, kind of half season. I remember, yeah, that was huge at the time. But then the Rockets ended up, I don't know if they regret it, but I'm sure there was marketing dollars to be made from that signing. But yeah, not the biggest. I think this actually, I would give it to Dwight from this. I think at the time that was seen as a pretty big deal. But Rick Barry, that also, it's so funny how archaic, you know, these old free agents, it's like, oh, they're going to lose a player? Like, that's not fair. We have to give them somebody in return. It's like the ridiculous labor laws. You can't just pick where you want to go play. But that's that was the NBA in the 70s, so, and before. But
sure, absolutely. Yeah. I think I would go with Pippen. It's really close with Pippen and Dwight. I would definitely toss up, but I think that, I think the fact that Pippen had been with, you know, the Bulls and been such a big part of that championship, and the story of him now trying to win it in another place, you know, kind of not exactly on its own, obviously, because there was Barkley and Olajuwon there, but as like, you know, that kind of the piece there to kind of like prove he could do it without Jordan, I think slightly bigger for me, but it's very, very close, and I think Dwight is a reasonable choice.
Yeah, that's fair. And that also, it, you know, kind of crazy that you know, Pippen does that, but actually gets much closer the following year in a different city. But
yes, yeah, right. So yeah, that's a good point. Next, we have the Indiana Pacers, and I think almost completely forgotten, Alex English in 1978, who began his career with the Bucks. And this was very much a case of just like a, you know, this honestly may be cheating a little bit because it was definitely not seen as a big deal at the time. He was very young, only at average, less than 20 minutes a game for the Bucks that year in 78, although he did have a bigger role in the 78 playoffs, and he had 26-point and 21-point games against the Nuggets of all teams, of course, who would play for later for many, many years, in a 4-3 series loss. So, you know, it was kind of one of these guys. He was just, you know, young and talented and kind of, you know, but, you know, wasn't an important part of the team's plans to not get poached by a different franchise. And it was the Pacers, of course, who then would later trade him to Denver in the infamous George McGinnis deal, bringing McGinnis back to the Pacers, which ended up, you know, kind of being disastrous for the Pacers and losing out on future Hall of Famer Alex English. Other names on here, and they're not super notable, Byron Scott, 1993, of course, leaving the Lakers, where he had spent his entire career, and going to the Pacers, and, you know, helping out a bit with some of their mid-90s teams. He was a good role player. This is more of a name than the on-court production. Al Harrington in 2006, coming back from the Hawks in a sign-and-trade after he began his career with the Pacers. And I think probably my choice for the winner here, David West in 2011, joining the Paul George, Roy Hibbert Hawks, ending up being, I think was a fairly big name at the time. Of course, had some really good years with the Hornets, so, and was still, you know, young enough to be productive, but was also, you know, big leader on that team. I think in somewhat similar to Oakley with the Raptors in 99, but probably even better on court production at that point. From
West. West is my winner here too. And I remember the other team that West kind of seriously considered signing with is the Celtics at that time. And that would have prolonged their little run a bit longer, but the Pacers, it was just, I remember being a natural fit. It's like that was their position of need. Found this guy, slotted him right in, and they immediately, you know, have three really good seasons in a row. So, I think that's my winner as well. So we'll see. Alex English, when you're talking about that, it's reminding me of, you know, we'll see. I think GMs are maybe slightly smarter than this, and I'm not trying to compare Alex English to this guy, but Terry Rozier, you know, kind of upcoming restricted free agent and having really big games in the playoffs and extended role due to injury. Let's see if anybody jumps at that and maybe offers him more than he perhaps should get, similar to Alex English in 78.
Yeah, that's a good. I think that's a fair comparison. That's kind of a good one to look at. So next we have the Sonics and Thunder franchise. Sort of an interesting NBA history, NBA free agent history. I guess interesting NBA history with them as well, but particularly in free agency. They have one of the most notable free agent signings of all time in Spencer Haywood in 1970, defected from the ABA, went, was not even eligible to be in the NBA because he was not of draft age, of course, filed a lawsuit to get that rule changed, and was basically attempts to made to disqualify him from games to because he was not an eligible player and so on and so forth, but he was obviously had a big impact on the NBA and the ABA in general, and was an excellent player as well for his time in Seattle, despite having issues here and there. But definitely a huge one. The other guys on this list, Gus Williams from 1977, coming from the Golden State Warriors, became a very important player, of course, in their championship team. I think at the time it was less significant. He was, you know, a good young player, potentially could be good. Maybe a little bit like Alex English, where you know, was up and coming, but was, you know, a lower level player on the Warriors, but got his shot with the Sonics and obviously became a big star during that time. And then for the Thunder, Nenad Krstić and in 2008, and Patrick Patterson in 2017 are the Thunder not known for high-level free agent signings. Derek Fisher also, I guess, could be included on this list. So I don't know if you were separating the Sonics and Thunder. I think Haywood's a pretty clear choice for the Sonics. For the Thunder, I am less clear on that.
Yeah, I think Haywood's got to take this one. And I think that stretch there, you know, 08 to 2017, or I guess, you know, you say 2016 when KD left, is really kind of indicative as to why that team, you know, partially never got over the hump. It's like that, you know, they drafted so well. It's kind of the gift and curse of drafting so well. It's like they kind of were married to that group and never really added that other piece, whether through a free agency or trade, that kind of got them over the hump, especially after the Harden trade. So I think that's kind of indicative of some of their failings as an organization, that Patrick Patterson and Nenad Krstić are the two biggest signings in that era.
Right, yeah, and Krstić probably could have worked out better, you know, had he given better health. That was kind of the, you know, obstacle for him.
Yep.
He seemed like a fairly good signing at the time, actually. But, yeah, I guess Patterson would have been the bigger star. So for just saying Thunder only, I would say Patterson is the biggest one. But, yeah, but overall in this group, if you're taking the franchise history together, which honestly you should, they're the same franchise, then I would say Haywood would be involved there. Next, your favorite team, the Spurs. Not really much in the 90s, despite their great success there, at least none that I was able to dig into. But starting in 2000, there's Derek Anderson, who was helpful for them briefly, was kind of seen as like an up-and-coming rising star, didn't really last there in San Antonio. 2001, these are more in retrospect, not necessarily huge at the time, but Bruce Bowen obviously became a great player for them. Steven Jackson was helpful for, you know, their 2001 championship before moving on to other franchises. And then Robert Horry at 2003, coming from the Lakers and providing some big shots, as he was apt to do for the Sonics through the mid-2000s, but probably the winner on this list, LaMarcus Aldridge in 2015, coming over from the Blazers, was, you know, a star level player at the time, you know, pretty all-star type guy, you know, second, third team All-NBA type player, probably, you know, in terms of stardom at the time. I think definitely, I think this is a fairly clear one to me.
Yep, no question, LaMarcus Aldridge. That's a big deal at the time. It, so much so that the Spurs have had such little, not even success. They just didn't really do it. Going after kind of big free agents like that, that it was kind of seen as like, is this like the Spurs going against their roots? You know, in San Antonio, there are definitely people who were like, I don't like that. This is the direction people are going, which is crazy. But it's like, yeah, you know, we're the built, not bought, you know, thing. That was kind of the prevailing thought at the time. But also, you know, the smart side of the fans were, oh, I'm excited we have a really good player on our team now. Derek Anderson was bigger, I think, than people realized at the time. That was like Spurs, you know, 99 coming off a championship, 2000. Duncan gets hurt, misses the playoffs, and, you know, they lose in the first round. And the Derek Anderson signing, people thought, hey, you know, here's this like young athletic wing that can like really help, you know, help the Spurs. And then he got hurt in the playoffs. Juwan Howard just leveled him on a play. And then really, really just did not having that guy against the Lakers was a huge deal in that Western Conference Finals that season. So, Derek Anderson was a big one, but this is easily LaMarcus Aldridge. Robert Horry, by the way, that one, so he signs in 2003. The Lakers, or the Spurs, had just beaten the Lakers in the 03 playoffs. He signs with the Spurs, and then the Lakers beat the Spurs in the 04 playoffs thanks to the Derek Fisher point four shot. So I'm sure at that time, Horry was thinking, you know, what did I do here? But then the following year, he gets his moment in the 2005 finals that everyone remembers.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus an 07, you know, knocking Steve
yes,
Nash to
a game,
ground.
A game I was in attendance yes. for. So, yeah, that was I do remember that go. One fondly.
Next, we have the Chicago Bulls, and very early one that I think is interesting. Larry Keenan, who had been a star for the Spurs and also on with the Nets in the ABA, and came on, was a shooting guard, played well for the Bulls. They actually had a pretty big turnaround from being about a 30-win team to a 45-win team. They also had Artis Gilmore, and they had Reggie Theus. You know, were actually, you know, some nice talent there. Jerry Sloan was their coach. It looked like this was definitely the high watermark between, you know, the, of course, those great early 70s, you know, Chet Walker, Norm Van Leer, Jerry Sloan teams, and of course the Jordan teams later. This was kind of the peak for there, and Keenan was kind of a big deal for that time. Other notable names, Ron Harper in 94, of course, that became more significant as when Jordan came back. Brent Berry in 98 was the first big free agent, post-Jordan free agent signing that they had. Ben Wallace in 2006, coming along from the Pistons, joining the rival Bulls, and then Carlos Boozer in 2010, and Dwayne Wade in 2016, I think were the other choices. So yeah, Boozer was a big deal in 2010 for sure. And he was a star and coming along that huge free agent summer, and you know that he was obviously more of a the consolation prize for LeBron, but that was definitely, you know, kind of seen as a chance for them to adding a good complimentary star who was gonna, you know, help them compete with the Heat and, you know, and with Rose as this, of course, is their big star. And and then Wade, I think, was more just a name, and obviously having the Chicago being from Chicago and coming from the Heat, the surprise of that was a big name type thing, but in terms of expected on-court impact, I don't think that was as big. I would say Ben Wallace here probably, but you know, I can be convinced otherwise.
Yeah, I was leaning Ben Wallace myself, but Boozer, Wallace, I guess it was a little bit more clear that he was slightly on the downside at that point, although, you know, he'd come off obviously a run of Defensive Player of the Year awards, but it was obviously like that wasn't going to continue, you know, whereas Boozer was more in the prime, and it was, I think, maybe fit that team's need a little more. And yeah, just kind of slotted right into that power four position. And really, you know, his first year was the best one, and then it kind of faded after that. So I think it's down to those two. And you can kind of flip a coin for me.
Yeah, I think Wallace maybe slightly. I mean, he was kind of expected to, you know, because they had a pretty good young team there, you know, with Ben Gordon and Tyson Chandler, you know, some good young stars. You know, Wallace was kind of meant to kind of come in there and bring the veteran toughness and rebounding and stuff, and still great defense. And yeah, he faded kind of quickly. And like I said, the fit was not particularly good there. But I think in terms of like the stardom at the time, I think I would place Wallace slightly over Boozer.
Fine with me.
But yes. Next, we have the Bullets and Wizards franchise, and only a few names here, but they are notable. Bob Dandridge, 1977, coming from the Bucks, who had, of course, been part of the early 70s championship teams, and joining a team that was poised for another couple finals appearances and one championship, and he was a very, very key component in that. Kind of the James Worthy of his time, you know, a good complimentary third star, you know, very good defender, clutch shots, all that good stuff. Bernard King, 1987, after the terrific, horrific knee injury, coming from the Knicks and joining the Bullets and having some, you know, productive scoring years there. And then Gilbert Arenas in 2003, create a new provision in the CBA that on for second round picks, but was able to basically the guy who turned the Wizards around after they'd had, you know, mediocrity for the most part for two decades, was, you know, led to some exciting teams in the mid-2000s, even though things did not end there particularly well, to say the least. But I have a tough time with this. I would say between Dandridge and Arenas, both very impactful in different ways.
Yeah, really. They, I mean, they all three have a case in a different way. I mean, Bernard King was, you know, I guess essentially the biggest name at the time, but the knee injury, I think everybody kind of knew that was not ever going to be the same. And Arenas probably had the most and the longest impact post his signing. But yeah, I would probably lean Dandridge. Just given how good that team was and how good, you know, he was at the time, just kind of fit perfectly. It's like the signing that made the most sense at the time. I don't think people expected as much out of Arenas as he ended up giving them.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he was more like, okay, young player who potentially could be great or could be very good, and they end up, you know, exceeding that quite a bit and becoming, you know, like a fairly big star. But that was, yeah, I don't think that was necessarily a realistic outcome in 03. So, yeah, it's, I might lean toward Arenas, but I could definitely see either way. For the Hawks, we have a handful of choices. Dan Rounfield in 1978, coming from the Pacers, was a pretty big star during the time, a couple-time All-Star, kind of forgotten about today. Moses Malone, 1988, joining after a stint with the Bullets. You know, he was a few years away from his MVP form, but was still very productive. You know, I think there was some thought there of, you know, him joining with Dominique Wilkins and the other incumbent Hawks. You know, that was something that could kind of take them over the top. Didn't really work out for them, but was big at the time. Dikembe Mutombo, 1996, I think the, you know, coming from the Nuggets and leading to a pretty good run in the late 90s for the Hawks as well. I think he was the key component in that. And then Joe Johnson in 2005, you know, was came from the Suns after, you know, he'd been part of the 6 seconds or 8 seconds or less era, excuse me, and some obviously led to some good years for them, eventually getting back to the playoffs and having a pretty long stint. And Paul Millsap in 2013 only signed a small deal. I think he was it was something that ended up being much bigger than I think people were expecting at the time. They thought he was a good player, but then he ended up just kind of getting better in his early 30s and becoming, you know, very productive for the Hawks, helping them their 60-win season and, you know, and all that. This one's,
yeah, it is. It is. It's kind of a tough one for me. Sorry, I don't want to be that guy, but I believe it's the 7 seconds or less ones. But I would lean. I think you said 6 and 8, didn't you?
You're right. 6 and 8. I did. You're right. I don't know what I was.
The truth is always somewhere in between.
Thank you for correcting me.
I would lean Dikembe Mutombo. But he had not reached kind of his heights yet. I guess Mutombo would be my choice because, you know, he at least had an NBA moment that, you know, that 94 team and certainly kind of changed the fortune of the Hawks. And that was another one. It's like, you know, people don't really usually sign with the Hawks. So that was kind of a big one that kind of swung their perception at least a little bit. But Millsap, given, I think if we did more like his production, given what they paid him, you know, he'd win that battle.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would go with Mutombo as well. I mean, I think, he was definitely the biggest star at the time. Like, Joe was, you know, like he was more like an upcoming player who potentially could have been big. And then he ended up having, you know, a long streak of All-Stars and it was a very, very good player for the team. But, I would say Mutombo, obviously the impact was more short term, but I think he was the biggest star that they were able to attract, given at that point in their career. Next, we have the Sixers. We have George McGinnis, 1975, coming from the ABA, signing as a free agent. There was a huge dispute with him and the between the Sixers and the Knicks over McGinnis. Eventually, the Sixers were able to win that battle. Moses Malone, 1982. This was basically Malone signed an offer sheet. The Rockets were, I think they did match, but then they ended up working out a sign and trade with the with the Sixers, getting a first-round draft pick and Caldwell Jones out of it, and Malone, of course, leading the team to the 83 championship, winning another MVP. And then Elton Brand in 2008, we alluded to this earlier when talking about Baron Davis with the Clippers, but I think he's the most notable recent one that they have they've been able to get. Who knows what will happen this year with the cap space they have and all the great young players that they have. But at this moment, I think pretty much there's no question about this with Moses Malone at 82 is definitely the biggest one they had. McGinnis was certainly a big deal as well, and he would, you know, had been a MVP for the ABA, but I think
this is definitely Moses. No qualms there.
Did for them. Next, we have the Pistons. Some okay choices here, but like you know, Brian Williams, Bison Deli, 1997, and Ben Gordon, Shelly Villanueva in 2009, Josh Smith in 2014. All we're seeing is, you know, relatively significant level signings, but the clear winner here, Chauncey Billups in 2002, you know, was I think, you know, a cut above these guys in terms of what he'd done for the Wolves, and obviously would accomplish much more, you know, would gain a lot more, but considering what he was at the time, I think, you know, this is not a illustrious list in terms of what they were seen as at the
yep,
at that
no
time
question. And I think Billups the Gordon and Villanueva one too, especially that was kind of seen as like a, hey, we have all this cap space, like we're gonna sign these two guys, and Gordon was just coming off that ridiculous series against the Celtics in the first round, 2009 first round, so I think people thought like, hey, this is a way for this Pistons team to kind of like start that next era, and boy did that backfire.
Yeah, I don't think those were seen as okay at the time, maybe a little bit overpriced, but like they were both seen as like guys, okay, they can fit, they're productive, like Gordon especially, but yeah, that just that was a disaster, like, you know, beyond you know, that was really, really bad, obviously. Lakers, team that have a pretty illustrious history. I would, you know, early on, Cassie Russell in 74, a very interesting early example of unrestricted free agency, almost as a technicality. Jamal Wilkes coming from the, of course, been a champion with the Warriors in 75, coming over in 77. Mitch Kupchak coming over from the Bullets, which was kind of seen as a big deal at the time, although it was disastrous because of Kupchak's knee injuries, although it didn't limit them from winning the championships they won. Sam Perkins, 1990, important player for the 91 championship team. A few other notable ones, Gary Payton and Karl Malone in 2003, despite being advanced in their career, were, you know, a big deal. Ron Artest, meta world peace, coming in 2009 and, you know, helping lead them to the second championship. And then Steve Nash in 2012, of course, and that not working out very well, but, you know, along with the trade of Dwight Howard, was expected to, you know, give the Lakers a, you know, they were thought of like, hey, they could be a super team like Miami was, but not really working out, of course, there. Of course, the winner here, without question, one of the biggest free agents of all time, Shaquille O'Neal, 1996.
Yeah, one of the biggest, both physically and just in terms of his impact on the court. Yeah, this is Shaq all the way.
Yes. Another obvious one, the Sacramento Kings. Really, not a whole lot of great candidates here. You got Terry Tyler, 1985, from the Pistons. Really, just more like a kind of a solid vet, but was one of the very few times Sacramento was able to lure anybody of notes to their team. Bobby Jackson in 2000, maybe even Sharif Abdul-Rahim in 2005, kind of at the end of that, you know, decent, good Kings run. But without question, Vlade Divac in 1998. Same offseason in which they added Chris Webber, Peja Stojakovic, and Jason Williams to the team. This was actually technically in 99 because of the lockout, listed as 98 in the tracking. And normally it would have been 98. But anyway, and Vlade came over as a free agent from the Hornets, and absolutely, you know, those players turned around the team pretty much right away, and they became a championship contender
within that was easy. A year. Bobby Jackson obviously played a role in that team, but yeah, Vlade was much more important. So this is Vlade.
Next, Boston Celtics. You know, despite, of course, having illustrious history, not a whole lot of free agents that were notable. You could look at ML Carr in 1979, who was part of ended up trading away Bob McAdoo, one of the half a dozen or so trades that McAdoo was involved in before he settled with the Lakers later on. And honestly, he was best known for towel waving for the mid-80s Celtics, but he averaged 18.7 points per game, 7.4 rebounds per game, 3.3 assists, and 2.5 steals, which led the league for Detroit that team. So he was, you know, a solid, pretty good star at that point. Pete Maravich in 1980 was just more of a name. Same with Dominique Wilkins in 1994. Better free agents, more impactful free agents, big names in the last couple of years. 2016, Al Horford, and 2017, Gordon Hayward. I would say at the point of their career that they are at, I think Hayward is probably the bigger of the two rather than Horford. Although I think obviously Horford,
I agree with that.
Overall, the better.
Yeah, I think Hayward. That was a huge signing, and I think will prove to be whether they use him in a trade or whether he ends up just playing for this team. But it is kind of crazy that a team that with this much history has had so few marquee free agents. But here we are. They're two latest, probably being their two biggest.
Yeah, absolutely. Next, we have the Warriors. Rick Barry, as we talked about before, I mean, kind of was really one of the first significant NBA free agents in NBA history in 68 when he left to jump to the ABA, was forced to sit out a year because of the option clause. Then Played a couple years for the ABA and then tried to sign with the Warriors, actually, I believe, in 1970. But there was a legal battle that prevented him from doing so. He ended up playing a couple years with the Nets and then went back to the NBA in 1972, back with the Warriors, and led them, of course, to the some good years, the 75 championship and all of that. Later on, some significant free agents. 2010, David Lee. That was kind of a respectable player is going to get for the Warriors again, which hadn't happened for a long time, at least free agency wise. And then Andre Iguodala, 2012. Ended up becoming joining up, of course, with Steph and Klay Thompson and Draymond Green to form the core of their championship team. And then I think clearly the biggest one, Kevin Durant in 2016, joining the 73 win Warriors to have them as perhaps get them to the point where they're going to be considered a dynasty. We'll see what happens beyond that.
Iguodala maybe like paved the way for that or for this current era of kind of Warriors basketball that he came off, he signed with them after their first playoff appearance of this run, but yeah, this is KD. Let's not overthink it.
Yeah. Barry, I think, has maybe some, he may be the runner-up here, but yeah, I think definitely KD. Last but not least, the New York Knicks. Not as much of one as you might have expected, given that their market, but they have a few notable ones. Marvin Webster, 1978, and this was coming off of an incredible performance in Game 7 of the NBA Finals with the Sonics. He'd also been part of the Nuggets in 76. Their road to the Finals had been like a number 3 overall draft pick, I believe, just a few years earlier. So he was a big deal, a great defensive big man, and it seemed like he was on the verge of being a star, and unfortunately some health issues derailed him. He had a kind of a solid career, but nothing particularly special, and the Knicks ended up having to trade Lonnie Shelton, who was important for the Sonics championship the next season. So it didn't work out for the best, but that was definitely a big name at the time. Bernard King in 82, coming from the Golden State Warriors, kind of rebuilding his career after some drug issues. They also added Paul Westphal and Ernie Grunfeld that offseason to remake the team and, make the playoff run in 84. Later on, Allen Houston, 1996, coming from the Pistons and, great shooting guard that they were able to add. And most recently, Amar'e Stoudemire in 2010. Of course, that huge summer was, again, more of a consolation prize, but obviously Amar'e was an absolute stud with the Suns. And I think really the only thing that limits him from being the definite choice on this list is, the injuries that were always, people realize that, okay, maybe the injuries are going to derail him, but there was definitely hope that he would be able to, be a big star for them. And he certainly was productive and helpful for a while. Carmelo coming in sort of limited that to a certain extent, and then the injuries kind of caught up with him, and then it ended up being a disappointment. But at the time, it was definitely.
Yeah, he's mine as well. Houston's big. Especially given his age, he was a young player. It's like you're going to get him for the prime of his career. But yeah, this is Amar'e for me. It's like a guy that embraced the New York thing. I mean, he was like he wanted to be the kind of the man there. Obviously, the hopes for LeBron, but that's okay. I mean, they ended up with a guy who for at least a short time kind of owned the Garden until Carmelo came in and Mike D'Antoni's overplaying, hurt his knees. An unfortunate, a short peak, but a peak nonetheless.
Yeah, and Bernard, I would say, like, once he, a couple years later in New York, he was obviously, he was the king of New York and all that, but I don't know if in 82 that was quite seen quite at that level. Like, he was definitely, intriguing, and it was a big deal, but he was not, I don't think it was quite seen as this.
Yeah, I think Bernard would be a choice if we were doing what free agent had the biggest impact, of this list. But no, yeah, I would go with Amar'e for me.
So that's it. That's all 30 NBA teams. Hope you guys enjoyed a look at this. Before we go, I want you to talk a little bit about your project you had at Basketball Pantheon about the greatest
moments in basketball
history.
Yeah, so this kind of started, really the beginning of this site was kind of a shout out to I'm a huge soccer fan, so there's this Irish writer, Miguel Delaney, who created the Football Pantheon way back, I think in 2011, I believe, and he kind of called the greatest moments in football history the crown jewel of his site. Now, what he did is a little more difficult because you're canvassing, the whole world of soccer and leagues from all over the world, and he's trying to narrow down to 100 moments, where I was just doing pro basketball, and specifically pro basketball, obviously, in America. I mean, NBA and ABA history, essentially. So the goal was just like, okay, how do I create something where I rank things based on different factors, and come up with a list that's not just like greatest buzzer beaters or greatest whatever, but kind of encompasses everything. So it doesn't have to necessarily be something on the court. And so that's why, we got some moments like the color barrier being broken or the shot clock being invented or things like that. And I on his site, I learned a ton through it because I once I got into soccer, I wanted to learn about the history, and there weren't as many tools to do that. And so, you know, he had videos with each thing, and I just thought that'd be a very cool thing to have on mine. And so I kind of viewed it as like, this is kind of the crown jewel of this site as well. So it started, you know, a few years ago, and really did most of the rankings about a year ago, kind of graded on 5 different pieces of criteria, and came out with about 250 moments, and then knocked off a bunch, and then never settled on an exact number. So I said, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to add to it each year, so I don't really care. So I kind of just started with the last one that I really wanted, which is a Brandon Roy moment from the 2011 playoffs, because I really liked Brandon Roy and kind of wanted to give him a shout out. So then I kind of went from there. So it's now at 168 after updating it for this year's playoffs. I added a couple more. And it finished on June 14th, which was just 10 days ago as we're recording this, which was Michael Jordan's last shot, which that date was the 20th anniversary of that shot. So that was a little bit of the vision for it. Once I realized that was going to be number one, I thought it'd be really cool to kind of finish the list on that day. And that's what I did. So very fun list. It was a ton of work. I hope people enjoy it. I know people are going to argue about it. That's fine. That's not really the point. The point is just to learn and kind of engage with the history of the league. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to put it. It's a learning tool. There are just moments on here that like, oh, I completely forgot about it, or oh yeah, I never really heard about that one. There's just so many that obviously there is, you know, the NBA and ABA have such an extensive, huge history of things. You, even us who have spent, you know, many hours, you know, learning about it, reading about it, and watching and all that good stuff, there's no way you can remember everything. So just having something like this as a guidepost to just kind of look at, okay, these are some of the great moments, and these are some of the really important things. And I loved how you try to look at like the criteria in different aspects of it, with, you know, wow factor, looking at the stakes, looking at the effect, looking at, you know, aesthetically what it looked like, looking at, you know, at what it meant for an era, or what, you know, how it defined an era, all those different things. I mean, I think you just you did just a wonderful job putting this together. It's a really really cool thing, really fun, really educational. We'll obviously have a link to it in the show notes, and if you haven't seen that, definitely you know, recommend bookmarking it, you know, digest some of it here, you know, just digesting it a little bit at a time, and, you know, keeping it active. And it's some good stuff. So I thank you
for the kind words. It was a lot of work, but definitely kind of a labor of love, and I hope people enjoyed as much as I enjoyed working on it.
So everyone, of course, you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Over and Back. If you want to leave us a rating and review, we'd greatly appreciate that. You can find us at The Step Back at fansided.com. There's lots of great articles. You know, we're going to be in the midst of free agency soon, so lots of great stuff as free agency happens. I'm sure there'll be some fun trades and other good stuff there. Always excellent coverage, whether it's just the latest news or good podcasts, or just you know, some fun features. Got it all there at The Step Back, so check that out. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA as well. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back again soon.